are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, March 14th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, we are talking with Liz Franzik on propaganda, guided democracy, the origins of public opinion formation and how it undermines democracy. She wrote a great piece, The Century of Spin, for The Baffler. Senate breaks with Donald Trump's support for the Saudi-led mass murder atrocities in Yemen, thanks to the efforts of Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy. We'll go into detail on that. Theresa May has a new Brexit plan rejected by the UK Parliament. New information in Brazil links directly the government of J.R. Bolsonaro, or the personality, the family of J.R. Bolsonaro, to the assassins of former Rio City Councilwoman Marielle Franco. That happened, we're coming up on the year-long anniversary of her assassination. And Beto O'Rourke is bringing, I don't know, the ethos of a West Wing devotional podcast to the 2020 campaign, asking us to risk the imagination of a new possibility or whatever. Please, dude, there's still time. Run for Senate. You could seriously help your country. Or not. We'll talk about that. Plus, Boeing grounding some of their jets. And ICE has been tapping into a vast license plate database, raising new concerns about privacy and surveillance. What a surprise. That comes in the heels of the reports on ICE monitoring journalists. And Facebook data deals are under criminal investigation. It's almost like these institutions have no respect for our civil liberties. And the Utah and Arkansas lawmakers pass 18-week abortion bans. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. There's a political calculation here about Beto O'Rourke getting into the race. And between him and Biden, this is going to most likely help Bernie Sanders. The only real competition in the progressive lane is between Sanders and Warren, and then to some extent, Gabbard. And there is a massive, from the center out to the right, I would say genuinely center-left candidate with some very right-wing streaks in her record, like a Kamala Harris. And then there's Amy Klobuchar running as a less charismatic version of Howard Schultz, with a worse organizational culture. Then, you have other candidates. And so, in that lane, Beto and Biden would really fill it out. And I guess the first takeaway that we have in this office is, one, in all seriousness, Beto O'Rourke's cool in some ways. He should run for Senate. He has buy-in in his home state. As a national Democrat, his voting record, and these and these measurements can be kind of silly, but the reality is that, leaving aside the fact, Bernie Sanders, a serious, committed leader for his whole political life. Elizabeth Warren, a serious, committed leader and policymaker. And then people like Harris, who've taken the lead on certain things in the Senate. Cory Booker, who's done great things on the drug war in the Senate. Beto votes well to the right of his Democratic colleagues. Now, that's not a problem when you're running statewide for the Senate in Texas, but why on earth would that be what the Democratic Party would want to go for in a time of that, you know, the crisis of inequality, the crisis of ecology, and the need to not only have this broad-based Democratic coalition, but actually see it represented at the highest levels? He doesn't tick any of those metrics. The only thing he ticks is definitely A, for the best Obama impersonation in the race. And here he is. I mean, look, we'll see if this gets filled in, but he is very much in the lane of, and I don't know if we're going to play his announcement video, but his announcement video has nothing specific. And one could come away thinking, whoa, he's talking about universal health care. He's talking about reparations. He's talking about immigration. He's talking about ending war. There's nothing in it. And this isolated clip, I mean, whoa, boy. It's as Matt, what did you say before, after you saw this clip about the soundtrack?
Oh, it's like he can hear the sort of swelling inspirational music they're going to put in the ad underneath it when they use it for media later.
Right.
But these challenges, I am absolutely convinced, will bring out the absolute best in every single one of us. And we have something that almost no other country in the world has. We have the single greatest mechanism to call forth the genius of our fellow human beings. This democracy, more than 320 million people strong, can bring the ingenuity, the creativity, the resolve of an entire country. And each one of these challenges can and will be met. But the foundational challenge to get all of this done is to fix our democracy. Only when it works, and only when each one of us can work within it, will we be able to meet these threats. And so this setting right now, the very first event of our campaign for president, is an example not only of the way that I wish to campaign across this country for every single American, and I could care less your party persuasion, your religion, anything other than the fact that right now we are all Americans and we are all human beings, and we do everything within our power for one another, for this great country, yeah, and for every generation that follows.
I don't think so.
So, he's not going to cut in to Bernie Sanders' vote share. Some early polls might show that, but there's a very basic distinction at work here. If you honestly believe, and I understand, I agree, I've been saying it for a long time, Bernie Sanders definitely has a certain type of grandpa charisma. And like all politics today, there's unhealthy personality cults that can form in pockets around any candidate, and we should, you know, try to disrupt that wherever we find it. In fact, most especially amongst candidates we support. But if you honestly think, if you're delusional enough to think that the young people, the people from every category of the society who finally responded to a candidate saying, look, the fact that there is no universal health care here, the fact that these companies are so predatory and so vicious, the fact that almost every category of life is getting more difficult for more and more people, and I'm going to do something about it, and I'm going to name names, and I'm going to take action. If you think that that's personality that can get undermined by some, you know, nice guy in a skateboard, I don't know how to put this politely. You're hugely divorced from reality. If you think that Bernie Sanders came out and gave that speech and said, like, and that's why it's a democracy, and here's more pablum, and here's other vague points, and here's things that actually in some ways borderline offensively erase a huge amount of American history because it hasn't been a real democracy in
actually ever, if we go back from the disenfranchisement of women to American apartheid to even today, the Princeton studies saying that this country is actually functionally an oligarchy. But I'm going to do generic, vague West Wing reference monologues and try to do an impersonation of Barack Obama. And people would have said, oh, my God, I don't care. I don't care what Bernie Sanders' policy record is. It's just that pure, raw charisma. It's a delusional argument, and it reveals why you would be interested in Beto. Because there's no policy argument for Beto. There's no political argument
for Beto. He hasn't even tried to make one yet.
He hasn't even tried to make one. And there's also, by the way, and again, we usually have this fight, and I make no bones about it. At the end of the day, the policy is what's most important. But obviously we recognize the hugely important need. It's not the overriding need, obviously, in my view, but the need to have a woman president, to have more people of color, to have a Latino president, and so on. He doesn't bring, I get that he's impersonating Obama, but he certainly does not bring that to the table. He is literally a rich white guy. And I will add rich to the moniker, and not Jewish, and not someone who grew up in poverty, and not someone who came from immigrants, and not somebody who's a lifelong activist. He's a nice suburban dad whose wife is totally loaded from real estate investments, who has a unusually right-wing voting record for a Democrat in Congress. And by the way, his district he represents is a Democratic district. So it's not because it's a Texas swing. And he's also Bernie Sanders. Oh, my God, he's an independent. He's an independent. Bernie Sanders has never stayed out of a race specifically to protect a personal friend of his who's a Republican. And by the way, this is one of these moments where a broken clock, and literally this broken clock might actually be a great way of describing Brian Kilmeade, is right every once in a while. This is Brian Kilmeade on Fox News.
All right, so Vanity Fair has a huge article and feature on him. It's almost as if they helped launch his campaign. Here's a quote from it. He says, I want to be in it, man. I'm just born to be in it. They also point out that...
I'm sorry. Could you imagine? I mean, look.
I'm just born to be this.
Literally. And again, I don't want to be hypocritical, and I'm someone who really is like, let's not focus on every little gaffe and let's not be super petty. But like, Bernie is a mission-driven politician. And then, so he would not, and he's also Jewish and he's also coming from poverty. Okay, so that's the clear one. But could you be Kamala Harris and say that? Like, literally, you couldn't because of the history and politics of this country. In fact, you could say, actually, because of the structures of this country in terms of inequity, I was born to not do this, if we're being blunt about it, and I'm fighting to overcome that. And if you combine that, look, again, this is the type of thing that if he said that and he had rolled out a series of serious policy proposals and his record matched it, then I'm not going to be petty about that quote. But if it's a conservative voting record in Congress relative to the rest of the Democratic Party and no proposals and vacuous nonsense, that the raw narcissism of that quote is going to stick out to me. But let's go.
Be in it, man. I'm just born to be in it. They also point out that he has this huge library, as if it's a big plus that he reads books. We would assume that. And he talks to all the presidential libraries there, and the writer writes, there's always a sense that he belongs on that, as if a book of a president's going to be in there. But listen, he's got a lot of charisma. He's got a lot of presence.
Get him, Brian.
Yeah, that detail about like he has a library, it does seem like the people who on dating sites put that John Waters quote where if you go back to somebody's apartment and they don't have books, don't screw them, but right. They like only might read like one book all year, but they keep it out on their coffee table.
Yeah. What did you say?
They keep it.
No, I was just.
Yeah, no.
I keep meaning to finish the new Jim Crow. You know what it is? He's got the new Jim Crow, but what he's really doing is rereading the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People for the eighth time.
Reads that Laws of Power book.
The Laws of Power book is too cool. But I think, we'll see. And it's funny, I'm not strategically, I think he actually helps Bernie, and I don't have any – I've liked and supported Beto, obviously, in his Senate run, so I'm trying to identify what annoys me so much about this. But I just think that there is something about just the raw just mediocrity and entitlement of it all. And then the fact that all sorts of people both – okay, I'll say both who will smear and slime and lie about Bernie all day, and then all of a sudden – will actually literally embrace just a, you know, the total generic white male. And then also combined with just the fact that the much more important point, which is like, guys, like this is in fact a really serious time, like a really serious time. And my argument for making a structural change in this campaign and our policy has never hinged on only Bernie can beat Trump. I think it's a ludicrous argument. And a lot will change in a year. And God forbid we might be in a situation where Trump's super formidable. I don't really see it. I think what's most likely is I think basically everybody, and I mean this honestly, maybe Amy Klobuchar. I'm not really sure about her. But I think pretty much any of these candidates could defeat Donald Trump. Sanders, Warren, Harris, Booker, Biden. I really do. So my argument does not hinge on that. But my argument actually hinges on a longer view, which is that, okay, we've stopped the emergency. We've got rid of this buffoon, disgusting, grotesque jackass as president. But what's next, guys? Like, the global crisis we're in does not just hinge on a few disgusting personalities. There is a reason why from Brazil to India, to Russia, to Hungary, to the United States, to the Philippines, to Israel, to, I would actually just include the UK straight up, there is a authoritarian leaning, if not overtly fully so, unbelievably xenophobic, far right to fascist politics. And I don't know all the answers, but I know that some of the answer is going to have to come from some form of like real serious cultural and moral, but also economic and strategic answer to this. So, you know, the year is 2022 and all of the trend lines are still bad. Maybe there's been some decent reforms put in place, but Beto O'Rourke is not doing anything structural for the economy. He's not doing anything structural on climate. And I'm not going to give you some vague, I'm not going to say like, what about the next Trump? Maybe worse. I don't know. There might not be anybody who's as bad as Trump. But even just the gridlock of insufficient and counterproductive neoliberalism with a party, or Republicans will still exist as a party. It will still be a oligarch white supremacy unity party. I don't know how much longer that dynamic is hugely destructive and incapable of dealing with the horizon of things like climate. So I just find, you know, this whole, like, really? We haven't moved beyond this? Like, we already had the guy who did – Barack Obama is the best politician of not only his generation but probably modern American history. And there was a time in some ways, and I make this argument to my leftist friends all the time, like you cannot discount the unbelievable cultural and leadership qualities of President Obama and what he did, just even having him there in office. And then again, I won't lie and cover for the profoundly insufficient and bad policies with regards to Wall Street or drones for that matter, as well as giving credit for where he did move the ball forward. But like we did that. We're going to do the Coke Zero version of that? Why exactly?
Anybody, yeah. if you get into an argument with somebody who's a Beto supporter and they're not, you don't want to bring up Bernie, why would you support Beto and not Buttigieg? Buttigieg's way better than, if you're talking about young white guys. Policy-wise, identity-wise, he's just better.
He's an openly gay man. That's hugely significant. And and you know what? He is a brilliant technocrat, but guess what? He said, everything I've heard from him is, I think he's for Medicare for all. Yep. He said, John Bolton shouldn't be anywhere near the Situation Room. We need to pack the court. We need to get rid of the filibuster. He's putting points on the board.
Yeah.
And he would make his own form of quite significant history.
Yep. Let's see Beto do any of those things that Buttigieg himself is doing. Then we can start talking about if he competes with Bernie Sanders.
Well, he's just not as charismatic, Matt, is the problem.
Yeah, okay.
There it is. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Liz Franzik. Back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Liz Franzak. She's a writer, and her recent piece in The Baffler, The Century of Spin, The Formative Days of Public Relations, Elites Imagined a quote-unquote guided democracy. Liz, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, Liz, my bad. Thanks so much for being here. You're here now.
Oh, thank you so much.
So, Liz, can you start by talking about the tale of Atal Gawande and his recent joining of Amazon, but his role as a public intellectual and the sort of branding of conscience or branding of credibility as a way to kind of open up this conversation?
Yeah, so it was very interesting. I when I was doing some research for this piece, I came across PR story about Atul Gawande, who I had known. He's published several New York Times bestselling books. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's a doctor and a professor at Harvard Medical School, where, you know, he's been on Oprah. I mean, he's very, very, you know, very popular, as well as a pretty vigorous defender of the Affordable Care Act. And I saw that he had been recently appointed to a new position, I believe it's CEO at Amazon's very secretive and I believe still unnamed healthcare venture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unclear exactly what Amazon is interested in, but the healthcare marketplace is a huge marketplace, as you could imagine, not just within the insurance market, but also medical devices, hospitals, administration. I mean, the list goes on. It's a massive part of our economy. And so Bezos had recently joined with not just JP Morgan Chase, but also Berkshire Hathaway in this joint venture. And so I found it very interesting that they would appoint not just a Harvard professor, a CEO, of which, it's a bit of an interesting sort of lateral horizontal move, right?
Right.
But also someone who had such a, highly respected and intellectual and quite liberal reputation within the sort of, intellectual discourse, particularly around the role of the government in healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Regarding debates around the ACA. And so, you know, it's a sort of an interesting move. And, you know, I write in the piece that you kind of call this usually like a public relations coup, right? Because mm-hmm. it's such a get, such a hire. But I think it tells us a lot about the ways in which these, you know, new monopolistic and, you know, rising monopolistic companies like Amazon sort of position themselves not just as companies that sell goods, but as companies that actually have a rightful place within our democracy.
And then you link this to a great document. I really enjoyed this. Adam Curtis's documentary on the century of the self. Mm-hmm. And when you point out, I like how you say every social media frenemy Kanye West tweeted mm-hmm. out, and this is the tweet. This is one of his tweets that's more like his old producing, and the fact that it's good, unlike some of his other tweets, which are more like his new records. But that's another conversation. It's 4 hours long, but you'll get the gist in the first 20 minutes, he wrote. Basically, Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, capitalized off of his uncle's philosophies and created modern-day consumerism. I think that actually is a pretty good description of at least some of the story Adam Curtis is telling in Century of the Self. First of all, I mean, who was Edward Bernays? And, like, is that actually true? Is the story a lot more complicated than that?
I do think it's true, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, yes, I love that documentary. I love all of Adam Curtis's films. Highly recommend all his films.
Definitely.
Just a great film essayist. But I do think it's funny that, you know, Kanye in that tweet, which you do point out, I think it is a good tweet, that he focuses on modern-day consumerism. And that was something I kind of wanted to pinpoint. And I do think that the popular narrative around Edward Bernays, who I'll get to in a second, is that, you know, what he was sort of pioneering was a way to sell us commercial goods, you know, famously certain tobacco products and Coca-Cola, and that it kind of, you know, spurned this kind of Mad Men style advertising bonanza that shaped a lot of the 20th century. And I think that's true, but I don't think that it's the whole story. And that's kind of what I wanted to do, sort of shade it a little bit. So, you know, Kanye and Adam Curtis and also, of course, Noam Chomsky and Stuart Ewan are completely correct in their positioning of Edward Bernays. He was Freud's nephew, famously, and wanted to sort of, in his mind, you know, popularize Freud for the Americans, you know, in the American popular imagination. But when I was sort of looking into him and looking into sort of what was percolating at the time that Bernays was writing his, you know, treatises on public relations, what I found is that, you know, public relations itself and what Bernays was advocating was really emanating out of what would come to be a much larger ideological project. And, you know, we, you know, neoliberalism has become such a, like, catch-all phrase for so many things.
Right.
And a lot of people like to dismiss it as, you know, that's either it's not a thing or it's like a slur, which I think is funny, or, you know, all these sorts of like hand waving away. But it was at the time that Bernays was writing, you know, and there were others as well that were looking at basically in the interwar years what they saw as emerging threats to liberal democracy. And that was both the rising threats of social democracy, socialism, communism, and on the other side of that, fascism, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in both of these projects, what they saw was, you know, democratic social planning, state-managed economies had to be, by definition, socially engineered, which meant that they had to supplant, particularly in the social democratic case, free capital markets, and which means personal liberty in their formulation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this was sort of an...
You have something. Please finish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm kind of rambling, but
no, not
this
at all.
Was sort of an emerging sort of theory of thought that was coming about, and what Bernays talks about in his theorizing of public relations, and why I kind of tie it to this larger ideological project, was that the idea was that not just that you could manipulate masses, right? That the masses left unchecked didn't know what they wanted, and that they should be manipulated. So PR as a technology, as a neoliberal technology, isn't just about, you know, changing people's minds in some sort of magical Freudian psychoanalytic perspective, but actually, you know, teaching people what they want because you know better than they do.
And that's where it's really, because we'll get to Mount Pelerin in a few minutes, but they think this is really important that you brought in the Lippmann work, right? Because Walter Lippmann is, you know, Bernays, I think, because people do probably primarily know who he is through Chomsky or Adam Curtis. And even though we're such a PR saturated society, it's still kind like that actually is kind of a slur, like, oh, you're a spin doctor, or that's PR or whatever. But Lippmann was a public intellectual, and Lippmann was a serious guy, and he had much more noble ends. However, you know, as you point out, in 1922, Public Opinion, which is his most famous work, was really a precursor to Bernays' own writings on public relations, and they're in it, you know, it's obviously Lippmann's concerns and orientations are different. They're less kind of commercial and crass, but they reflect that kind of elite preoccupation of, okay, there's going to be a democracy, I guess. Like, we don't want to have a fascist totalitarian society, but we also certainly don't want, like, you know, labor unions to run this country, or people to, like, actually be democratized. They need to be guided. And maybe that is where the kind of guided terminology comes from. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So Lippmann is sort of credited with that exact term, guided democracy, which, you know, I point out is quite, and also it seems you are pointing out, is quite paradoxical, right?
Right.
And it's sort of, you know, he was, from my understanding, is that he was initially very critical of the role of propaganda and public relations. But also, like you say, you know, had concerns about, you know, the unwashed masses being responsible for themselves. And this is that sort of elite, this is where that kind of elite managerial technocratic view of liberal democracy comes from. That, again, there are, as you know, Lippmann says, you know, statesmanship consists in giving the people not what they want, but what they will learn to want. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very instructive to the ways in which these sort of elite technocrats, whilst believing that they're, you know, I don't think it's cynical. I think they really believed that they were committed to a better and just society, but that there is a resentment and a fear that is attached to the threat of social democracy.
And then that leads us maybe more like aggressively to the Mount Pelerin Society, right? So, like, if I'm understanding the threads, we have Walter Lippmann, who is the public intellectual who's, you know, I think probably clearly in your mind and in my mind, super dangerous and wrong-headed, but sincere and concerned and so on. And then Bernays is the, like, hey, I can flip my uncle's stuff about, you know, neurotics in Vienna to sell some cigarettes and make a hell of a lot of money in the new world. Let's do this. And then we get to Mount Pelerin, which really, I mean, it's first of all, maybe explain Mount Pelerin a little bit, because it's so crazy, because I feel like if you're in political media, you actually in some ways spend a lot of time kind of being like, well, you know, of course there's power and of course power runs things, but like, you know, don't be Alex Jones about it. It isn't necessarily a smoke-filled room. Mal Pellerin kind of was like one of the closer mm-hmm. things in history of like, actually, yeah.
Yeah. This, like a smoke-filled Swiss Alps resort, you know.
Right. So what was it and what did they do and how does it fit into the story?
Yeah. So, well, Mal Pellerin, so that was in 1947. And that was a meeting that came about almost a decade after the initial meeting, which was the Colloque Walter Lippmann. That was actually the name of it in Paris. Mm-hmm. So in 1938, just to continue the thread as you were laying out. So in 1938, you have the meeting in Paris, which inspired by Lippmann's inquiry into the principles of the good society, in which he makes a pretty strong critique of New Deal statism, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got Lippmann there and also the classical liberal and libertarian economists and philosophers of the time. So Michael Polanyi, Rothko, Rousseau, von Mises, but also very, very crucially, Friedrich von Hayek. Mm-hmm. And here, this is actually quite literally where the term neoliberalism is coined, not at Mount Pelerin, but in 1938 in Paris. And it's here where they start discussing how, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about it, but classical liberalism had kind of gone out of fashion during the interwar years because it was completely and wholly incapable of dealing with, the economic collapse that had faced the country as well as the World War One, right?
Right.
And so they're trying to refashion a new sort of way of looking at it, or kind of a rebranding, if you want. And then, so here they coined this new term and this new project. And then about a decade later, some of those same people, as well as other bigger names that you might recall, such as Milton Friedman, mm-hmm. Meet now under the direction of Hayek in Mont Pelerin. And this is where, I think it's about 40 or so intellectuals. I mean, it's a huge, huge meeting. And here, this is where Hayek starts really to start formulating a lot of his ideas. And I think Corey Robin had a piece recently, I think it was in the Boston Review, that's quite good, about Hayek's singular vision. And the neoliberals were they didn't like the idea of there being a single architect, funny enough. They liked the idea of their ideology being so diffused and so, that there's no one single person to point to, that it sort of just had this sort of natural feeling to it as it spread everywhere. But Hayek really is, I mean, his vision is total, mm-hmm. I think, in a way that, only a handful of philosophers can maybe make claim to. But so, yeah, go
on. No, go ahead, go ahead.
No, but just that you're right that Mount Pelerin, is a really singular event, and that what it led to was basically, the idea that, like I said, there wasn't a single architect, but that there would be a generational commitment across the globe to, what would become, the sort of neoliberal attack, primarily in economics, but also within academics, political science, education, particularly in the American sense, also within social democracy in Western Europe.
And also how it would filter in this way that, like, sure, on one hand, neoliberalism's overused, and it's both because some people who are, they misuse it or they throw it around too much, and then other people like Jonathan Chait want to kind of you know, be dunces and pretend that it doesn't exist, right? And then there's like, but there is the way in which part of the reason it's used so much is because it is an all-consuming ideology. Like it is, it has been the hegemonic ideology of our time. And it does not only set macroeconomic policy, but even when, you know, as an example, someone like a great theorist like Mark Fisher was like self-critiquing the left, or, you know, in terms of subcultures or political parties even, he could document and show the way that this ideology had seeped in and was creating practices and ideas, even in the areas where people thought they were resisting it. So it is really this all-consuming thing. And I think that I want to, we're going to get to the unguided plutocracy in a minute, but I want to put it in relation to Quinn Slobodian's book, where, and I'm forgetting the name of it, unfortunately, but Matt, what's the name?
Globalist?
Yeah, so it's like, and what, yeah, totally. Thank you. So he basically documents that, first, that yes, these people that you've been talking about did have a global project, and the problem with it in the popular discourse, though, is that it wasn't the effort. It wasn't like, oh, we're the guys who are responding to social democracy and Keynesianism and so on, or even communism, by saying, you know, let the market be free, let's deregulate, let's be less bureaucratic. That even people who've critiqued them have ceded that ground to them. And actually, that's totally wrong. Their project was tremendously bureaucratic and tremendously governmental. It just was in a way that favored the interests, frankly, of the wealthy and landowners and corporate interests versus the sort of beginning steps of social democracy, of democratic mechanisms favoring like workers, as an example. And I feel like what your piece is doing is not only showing that, but also showing the cultural dimension of it, which is getting this like broad-based buy-in to an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that a right way to think of it?
I think you know, Wendy Brown, the political theorist, she's done some great work sort of explicating how, you know, neoliberalism isn't just, you know, an economic theory, like you say, or isn't just its domain. It's not just limited to those domains, but actually, you know, it was sort of a larger rationality, right? Mm-hmm. When we say ideology or rationality, but that also demanded kind of a new conception of the self, right? And this is where it gets very dangerous. And you see it where she talks about, you know, that it economizes, neoliberalism economizes every aspect of our life. So you have, instead of thinking of the self as human, as a self, as a being, we start to conceive of ourselves as human capital, things to be, and choices that we make in our life as ways in which to either, you know, appreciate or depreciate our social value.
Right.
And you see this as markets start popping up even in non-economic spheres within dating. This is a perfect example. Social media is a perfect example, you know, and all of these ways we start to, you know, this also has the intended and cascading effect of them breaking, further breaking down social bonds.
Right.
Because no longer are we people with social ties, but we are just bits of human capital in competition with other bits of human capital, right? And so that also then further, like, entrenches the idea that all of these markets and the way that the sort of world is being governed is completely natural and rational. Because when you start to think of yourself as that way, then of course that is how the world is, right? And so it's quite dizzying, you know? And I think there's a good reason why, well, I think there's a lot of reasons why Jonathan Chait says that neoliberalism isn't a thing. I won't get into the non-generous reasons why I think he says that.
By the way, you can, if you want, you could take a few cracks. We're not above that here. But maybe you are, so no problem.
No. I mean, I think, why would you admit to being the thing that everyone hates? You know what I mean?
Right, but, word. Okay, I buy that. That's not even that ungenerous. That's just true.
No, yeah. It isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't.
Yeah.
No, but I do think that, you know, there's a reason why it's very difficult to kind of point to and figure out just how we got here and who is responsible. You know, and I don't think that that's unintentional. But I do think in America, it is unique. You know, I will say that I do think in Europe, you know, they at least have a bit more of a vocabulary and a history within their popular discourse and their popular punditry for what we call neoliberalism. And, you know, in America, we really don't.
Right.
And I do think, you know, you bring up Jonathan Chait, although there's plenty more people to name. When you have a media class and a, you know, public intellectual class that not only, you know, was schooled in and went through the ranks of this very system, right? Because this revolution really starts to take place in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. At least within the global north, you know, either they still believe this is just the way things are, that nothing can, you know, this is the end of history. There is, you know, we have post-politics. This is just how everything is naturally.
Right.
Or they have a vested interest in maintaining this, right? Because it maintains their position. So you've got kind of both things happening, as I think you mentioned, and as also, you know, that book Globalists really lays out clearly.
Totally. And then it's interesting because I do think of like a great essay, like Exiting the Vampire Castle, where it's sort of like first these markets can get replicated in subcultures that actually undermine solidarity and broader efforts. And of course, there's all sorts of complications there, but it is like a real factor that Fisher identified. And then also, these mainstream, this is like the kind of like pseudo woke politics where it's like, okay, maybe we can absorb, you know, and it is particularly people, well, actually Chait, to his credit, has not upgraded his racial understanding of this country at all. So in a way he's maintained like a weird consistency, including in like not pretending to be woke. But, you know, like there are, you definitely, I mean, David Brooks, I mean, he wasn't known for like particularly inflammatory writing, but this guy literally came up through like the Weekly Standard ranks. This is not someone with any type of, you know, documented sophistication or nuance about race at all. Well, now all of a sudden he supports reparations. And on one hand, it's like, okay, that's a great cultural step that a conservative in the New York Times would grapple with that. But then it's also like, oh, you want to, there should be psychic restitution, not material ones. Okay, I see how this works. You can definitely still operate in your same logic, even as you upgrade the context around it. And that's how pernicious it is.
Yes, definitely.
What is unguided plutocracy in the last couple of minutes?
Good question. So what's been interesting is that now that we've kind of laid all of this out, you know, there, you know, our society does not look like anything that the neoliberals actually envisaged, right? Because they didn't want chaos, and they didn't want, they certainly didn't want Donald Trump to be president. You know, the vision for sort of lean states that secured private liberty whilst maintaining, you know, calm global markets, you know, that is not what our actually existing society looks like, right? Quite the opposite, as we've got not just what's happening in America, but also, you know, the rise of the far right all throughout Western, Central, and Eastern Europe, as well as in Central America with Bolsonaro. And so, you know, after the 2008 crisis. And I do think, especially with the failures of the Obama administration to address that crisis in any meaningful way, this sort of technocratic elites have lost all legitimacy.
Right.
And this is where we see this sort of chaos and this populist rage percolating and brewing throughout the world. But what's been interesting is that sort of on the flip side of that, flip side of the right, is that we have this sort of rise of the return of this sort of liberal, not necessarily technocratic, but definitely bourgeois liberal, clustered around sort of democratic urban party power. And they have run not into democracy, not trying to envisage a new society or a better society, but into the arms of the companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook.
Right.
And as these companies continue to put, and this is where I sort of tie it to Mr. Gawande, or Dr. Gawande, in that, the corporations play into the hands of this. You know, if we've got Donald Trump in the White House and, you know, dismantling the American regulatory system and finishing off in a lot of ways a lot of what the neoliberal project initially was in terms of complete and total privatization, then you've got, on the flip side, liberals running into new emerging governance structures from privatized companies.
That's that unbelievably stupid and horrible SNL sketch. And I say this like every other friggin', you know, of course I don't like SNL. I almost wish I could say I like SNL to play against type, to be honest with you. But there was that sketch that really did stand out with Steve Carell, where the whole premise is, you know, here's Jeff Bezos trolling Donald Trump, and we're laughing with Jeff Bezos at Donald Trump. And it's incredible the shrinkage. Like, there's no, you know, again, I mean, don't write the sketches for the politics, but the ideology of that show just distilling that, like, there isn't a movement in this country that's saying, you know, Amazon is a fundamental threat to supply chains, democracy. People are trying to kill themselves all over the country at these warehouses. And Donald Trump is a totalitarian racist fulfilling, you know, all of these. So maybe comedy or rebelliousness just in general, maybe should object to both of those. But the whole sketch is just like, you know, Amazon is cool. I watch cool shows on Amazon Prime. Donald Trump's a jerk. But Jeff Bezos is going to win because he's smarter. I mean, that really is the distillation of the whole corruption and failure you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, so much of it comes down to Donald Trump is so personally disgusting.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just aesthetics
that
they find so disgusting because, you know, Donald Trump dismantling the state and allowing corporations to rise. These are not things in disagreement with each other, right? Like, these are not two ideological forces battling it out. Like, it's quite the same project, actually. And so it's really dangerous, I think, and really needs to be pushed back on this idea that there are good corporate overlords or that these CEOs have anything to do with our best interests. It's horrifying, actually. And I think, you know, Amazon is a good example, but also Facebook.
Totally.
You know, it was recently, I don't know if you saw recently, they just announced this like pivot to private. Have you seen this?
And the criminal probe that's opening against them around their data practices. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, this pivot to private, you know, a lot of people I saw really applauding it and, you know, oh, Zuckerberg is learning and he's responding not just to consumers, but citizens and
Jesus
their concerns
Christ.
About democracy and whatever, whatever, right?
How naive
but
can people be?
Like,
I'm sorry, go
well,
ahead.
Well, it's not just naive.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you really have to take a step back, you know, and look at what is, you know, what are these structures of production actually? Right. And I think what you see is you know, first of all, private does not mean privacy.
Right.
Right.
Right,
so what does private mean? Okay, well, Facebook's entire structure is around extracting data, right, and hoarding data. So private interactions, if you're having more private interactions, then you're possibly having more meaningful interactions, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're having more meaningful interactions, then Facebook is able to extract more meaningful data.
Right.
And so this isn't a move or a pivot away from their initial, you know, business practice. It's really, you know, they're not, it's, you know, an intensifying of their data extraction. And yet it's being billed or it's being sold to us as a civic good, as a virtuous move that they're doing. But it's not. And so this has the sort of, again, cascading effect of, you know, further disorienting us, not just as consumers, but as citizens, but then also regulators and politicians, right?
Right, right.
So it's quite dangerous. We have to really take a step back and try as we can, as much as we can, to escape or at least push back on some of the ideological framework that we exist in somehow, to take a you know, a more critical look at these systems of exploitation and production, so we can really understand what is you know, at stake and what is going on here.
I don't want to be presumptuous, Liz, but we only have a minute left. It sounds like you're pretty stoked for Beto to run for president.
Oh, man, yeah. Love him.
I think he's hitting exactly the themes that you're writing and talking about here. The piece is excellent. It's Century of Spin, The Baffler. We have links to it. And actually, I hope we can definitely talk more. I think this stuff is incredibly important. And you do a great job laying it out. Liz Franzik, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks. All right, folks. Seriously, read the piece. And if you haven't, watch Century of the Self. It really is a great documentary.
I'm pretty sure it's available on YouTube or online somewhere else.
That's how I watched it too. So unless anything has changed, you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how conversations and analysis happens, like you've just heard in the first half of the show. Go to join the Majority Report. There's a link on the show homepage as well as a specific URL. JustCoffee.coop, win-win-win for everyone. And join Majority Report today. Of course, also become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show today. This weekend on the Illicit History, we're doing an illicit history of Medicaid and a broad strategy for single payer that can overcome the problems of universal programs in the past with Professor Jamila Mishner from Cornell University. She's brilliant. And of course, there was a Tuesday show with John Iadarola and Joshua Kahn. Go to our YouTube page, Michael Brooks Show YouTube page, where you will see a trailer that we're doing for video versions of Illicit Histories for Comrade and Above patrons, but some of them will certainly also be unlocked.
Yeah, it's too late for you to be among the first 30,000 subscribers to that channel, but if you want to be among the first 40,000, get in the next couple of months.
Get in there.
Weeks.
Well, actually.
Weeks, actually.
Yeah, because it's the first 31,000 now. We cracked 31,000. And also, great clip, Joshua Kahn, who's a executive director of Wildfire Project and a really brilliant guy and organizer, he did a coaching lesson for us on how to organize using The Simpsons and a graphic that has been used for trainers going back to MLK and Rosa Parks and how to actually build a coalition and wield power. So we're doing a lot of things over there, patreon.com/TMBS. Matt, and of course, get your tickets to the LA live show, April 20th, Bootleg Theater with Anna Kasparian, all of the TMBS team, Big Waz, Wazi Lumbre, and Nando Vila. It's going to be an incredible show. There's a link on the Majority Report homepage, and we're about halfway sold out with still several weeks out. So get your tickets today. Matt?
Yeah, on the Literary Hangover YouTube channel, as of a few hours ago, the Wakefield episode is up there, so you can check that out. This weekend, we're talking about King Philip's War, and in case you're wondering, I'm a Team King Philip. And
I'm interested as to why.
Because, I mean, are you familiar with King Philip's War?
I know nothing about
this. It's interesting because, like, a lot of this, I'm learning a lot of Massachusetts and sort of New England history through all this stuff. And King Philip's War was basically, like, I think it's 40 years after the Pequot War, where basically the colonists just decided.
Pequot genocide.
Yeah, genocide.
Right.
King Philip's like, hey, if we don't do something about these colonists, we're not going to have any land. They're basically just surrounding us with new settlements. So they decided to, you know, at that time, they had guns by this point. The embargo against selling Native Americans guns just didn't work. And Native Americans were better at using guns than settlers were because they hunted and settlers farmed. Right. And so for a while it looked like the colonists were going to get pushed off the continent. But eventually they were able to, the colonists did win the war. But going to Mary Rowlandson's captivity, it's sort of the first American bestseller. She got captured by Native Americans, by King Philip's people. And actually she became like part of for the 11 weeks she was gone, become part of the economy by sewing, and basically they incorporate her into the economy.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. So we go deep into that. So look forward to that this weekend.
All right, folks, calls and IMs are open. We'll see you in the fun half.
So we take one. La poupe qu'il fait non.
Fuck off.
I give her my love, she says no, 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 no. I give her my heart, she says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only a friend to me, only a brother to me. Ask her to walk with me. She shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who said no, 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 no. All run that time through, she says no. Ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever say say no.